I don't know how many of you have heard of the sword of Damocles. He was a courtier in the court of Dionysius II of Syracuse in the 4th century B.C. And he was pandering to his king, and he said, Damocles did, that as a great man of power and authority surrounded by magnificence, Dionysius was truly fortunate. So realizing the folly of Damocles, Dionysius offered to switch places with him so that he could taste firsthand that fortune. So Damocles could think of no other place he'd rather be and quickly accepted the king's proposal. He sat down in the king's throne surrounded by every luxury, but Dionysius arranged that a huge sword should hang above the throne and his head, held at the tip only by a single hair of a horse's tail. So Damocles finally begged the tyrant that he be allowed to depart because he no longer wanted to be so fortunate. So the sword of Damocles was the threat of violent death if the string of the horse's hair broke while the guy was sitting on the throne underneath the sword. And because of the horse's hair as the only thing holding it, he lived in mortal fear that it was going to break and drop on him. And it became then a metaphor for having the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. And I thought of that when I was looking at the information in Galatians 1. This evening we're going to look at verse 10 in the biblical text that I use on my computer. Verse 10 is isolated from verses 6 through 9 and from verses 11 and following as if it's a standalone statement. And in some ways it is. Verses 6 through 9, there is a very confrontational opening statement or salvo that is pretty hard-hitting, and it ends with this double declaration of the inevitability of the cursedness of those who preach a different gospel than the one that the Galatians received. So in verse 10, we have the words in the New American Standard, "For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God, or am I striving to please men? If I were still striving to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ." So this evening what we're going to do is pick up on the study that we did last time on the issue of the preaching-receiving methodology of the gospel. Three times in verses 8 and 9 he used the word preach, and at the end of verse 9 he used the term "which you received." And of course, the preaching receiving is the methodology of salvation. In verse 6, the Father had summoned them to himself by grace. And that summoning or calling was a calling to relationship with himself. And that's the issue, bottom line issue, of the promise of eternal life. So salvation is all wrapped up in this relational connection between the Father and those who trust in him. So the preaching and the receiving that is mentioned in the cursing of verses 8 and 9 is the methodology of how that whole salvation issue works, how the relationship is fundamentally initiated and sustained, and that is the truth is proclaimed and the hearers believe it. That's the receiving. And we saw in our study last time, that chapter 3, verses 1, 2, and 3, he wants to know one thing. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law, by the hearing of faith? And there he's picking up off of this issue. They heard the gospel in verse 1 of chapter 3 that Christ was crucified, with implication that it was for our sins. And then he said on the heels of that, I just want to know one thing, and if you answer this, everything else will fall into place. And that is, how did it work? What was the method that made it effective? Did you receive the Spirit? So receiving the Spirit, embracing the gospel that Christ died for our sins, being summoned by the Father into relational interaction between Father and believer, all of these terms have to do with the issue of the gospel, being saved. And receiving the Spirit is his way of saying in chapter 3 that's the fundamental provision, because he is the way that life is imparted to us by the Father. And he says, I just want to know this. Did you get that? Did you get the Spirit? When you did something, or when you heard something and believed it. And of course they knew the answer. They hadn't done anything. It was the fact that they heard this message and they believed it. So the Spirit came into their lives and into their as an indwelling presence on the basis of preaching and receiving. So that's what's going on. And in verse 10, we have this interruption notion. It shifts gears really quickly. It looks like he's anticipating that somebody's going to get offended by the double cursing, verses 8 and 9. And he wants to address that offense, if he can. And he says it, as I said, with the New American Standard Translation, with two questions and a declaration. Am I seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men? And then, if I were still trying to please men, I wouldn't be a bondservant of Christ. So that's what he says as a response to an anticipated response to his, I call this holy harshness. Verse 8 and 9 are holy harshness. And what I mean by that is that it's legitimate, it's holy, it's in harmony with the character of God, but it's as harsh as it can be, because being a curse means you go to hell forever. And he double stated it. So that's the real harsh side of the issues of whether you believe what you heard or not, whether you receive the preaching or you reject it. So that's what's going on, and the issues of preaching and receiving are both drenched in the biblical concept of grace here, because God is the one who sponsored the beneficial actions that were contained not only in the gospel proclamation, but in the content that the gospel was proclaiming. God initiated the crucifixion of the Christ as a redeeming sacrifice. He initiated the plan that Jesus would come down here and effectively become the Redeemer. It wasn't something men dreamed up or wanted or even asked for. So it was all of a gracious thing on God's part to provide what he required so that he could give then the outcome of that to anybody who believed. And the receiving, obviously, is just as gracious, because the preaching that happened in Galatia was not sponsored by the Galatians in anything that they had done. And when they heard, their capacity to believe what they heard was not something that they ginned up, because it was so out of the possibility that they could just hear the content of the gospel and believe it on the basis of their own ability to believe things. Their faith was generated by the internal ministry of the Spirit, who convinced them of sin, righteousness, and judgment. They didn't have anything to do with that. That was something the Spirit did so that they could respond with faith. And the other thing was the miraculous activity of the apostle as he went about his business in those cities, and witnessing the supernatural power and having this work of the Spirit on their behalf was what enabled them to yield to the truth of the gospel, and that's what we call faith. So even their believing and receiving was a grace-based thing. It wasn't something that they could make happen. It's something that they could only yield to as it happened to them. And that's the biblical concept of salvation by grace through faith. So it's all about grace in this book. And that is the basis for the double statement of cursing in verses 8 and 9. Because you either come to God by grace through faith, or you don't get there. And if you don't get there, you don't get the life. And if you don't get the life, then you're going to be banned from participation in the kingdom. You will be cast into outer darkness. The double curse will be applied. So that's the issue. And that means then that we need to see if we can understand what he's really doing in verse 10. I've already said that I think he's reacting to what he's anticipating as a reaction. There's nothing in verses 6 through 9 that would automatically tell us why verse 10's there in so many words, because it's pretty clear that he's asking why he's doing what he's doing. Even the word now is a word in the Greek that means just now. Am I on the heels of these things that I've just said to you in verses 6 through 9? am I, whatever he means by seeking the favor of men or God or striving to please men, he's asking about his own motivation. He's asking them to think about his motivation. But he's asking that on the heels of, I think, an anticipation that they're going to be put out with him for what he said. And it's pretty clear. Verse 6 is fairly strong accusatory stuff, and that generally raises a reaction. And then the statement in verse 8 that there's this curse that awaits those who twist the gospel and then turn around and say, and if I didn't say it clearly enough, let me say it again. So it's very much like he's, you know, he has really speared them painfully. And he expects that they're not going to particularly like it and wonder where he's come from. So he's going to tell them, verse 10, where he's come from. So this evening what I want us to do is think about the issues in verse 10, and it's made a little more difficult by the translators in the New American Standard. I'm not sure the King James is any more helpful, but at least the King James terminology, which says, am I now persuading, uses the word persuade. That's a translation of a word that Paul used from the Greek, which we call pytho, and it's a verb that is used some 50 odd times, I think, in the New Testament. And the Greeks knew what it meant, but we don't tend to have that good of a grip on it. And as a consequence, there's some problems with the translator's choices of words that make it hard for us to figure out what's going on here. And I think that they missed it. And I'll tell you why. The New American Standard almost gives you the impression that he's asking the same question twice. Am I seeking the favor of men doesn't sound much different than am I striving to please men. So they either got it right and he's asking the same question twice with a little shift in his words, or they just completely missed what he was saying. And that's the issue. So I want us to start this evening by looking at Paul's attempt in his words. What's he saying in verse 10? What does he mean by it? And what does that bring to light for us? So, I want to start by saying something that I've already said multiple times, but I remember saying it emphatically a few studies back, and that is, there is a consistent biblical reality that is stated like this. What you believe matters. The Bible approaches things from the profound levels, not from the superficial ones. What you do matters to some degree. But what you believe that drives what you do, that matters more. Because that's what's causing the behavior. And if there's anything more important than what you believe, it's what you value. Because the values drive the faith that drives the action. And so in order of importance, faith is in the middle between the loving and the doing. But we cannot get away from the fact that ever since Genesis 3, when the devil said that God had lied, from then till now and to the end, everything hinges on whether God told the truth or not, and whether you're going to believe him or not. And so everything's by faith. From then on, that's the big issue. So we have to understand that we probably don't believe half the things we say we do, and we probably do believe some things we don't even know we believe, and we probably believe some things that we deny that we believe. But the fact is, what we believe matters. And so because it matters, we need to think carefully about it. And the most significant underpinning of belief in a biblical sense, because you know in the Bible, if you believe a lie, that's called unbelief. But you really have believed the lie. The Bible just doesn't recognize it as faith, because we said 2 or 3 weeks ago that biblical faith always has God as its object and the content of what he has spoken. So if you believe in something besides God, that's called unbelief in the Bible, even though you're actively believing in something. And if you believe a lie, that's called unbelief, even though you're very much committed to it as the truth. It's just a lie. You just don't know that. So we use the term belief without regard to the object or the content. We just mean yeah, this is true. At least that's the way I see it. But the Bible doesn't look at it quite like that. When you believe biblically, that means God is there and truth is the thing that you have committed to. So the most significant underpinning of faith in the Scriptures is truth, big T. And the sword of Damocles being suspended by the horsehair of belief in the truth is the problem. Because God and what He says is no horsehair. That's more like a titanium column, 12 inches thick, with the sword buried in the titanium so that there isn't any possibility at all that it's going to fall. You could live under the thing all day, every day, with no fear, no sweat, nothing. If you're talking about the suspended sword as a matter of whether it's God and His truth, that's not where the problem is. The problem is in human response to the truth. That's the belief thing. Salvation by grace through faith means on the grace side, there's no problem with that. The problem is on our side, our response, our faith. So, in that light, the problem of belief is a issue that Paul already raised in proclamation and receiving. That was the issue, the preaching and the receiving. On the preaching side, the only issue there is whether the preaching is true. If it's true, there's no problem. On the receiving side, the problem is whether you can embrace that as truth as a yielding issue, where you yield to the proclaimed reality. Well, the problem in the belief issue is that there are several problems. The problem is there are several problems. You have to be able to determine whether what you're hearing is true, and generally that's going to be bits and pieces of the big T truth. So you have to be able to decide whether the particular things that you're hearing are actually true, and then you have the even more difficult task of yielding to that. Because it's not enough to know that something is true. It's not enough to even recognize that it's true. If you're not going to yield to it, you haven't believed it's true. So, man has a double problem. That's the horsehair. He has to be able to recognize whether the thing that he's hearing is true. Like yesterday, James and I were listening to one of these TV preachers, and he made some very true statements about what God can do. God can, you know, on the super miraculous side, He can raise the dead, He can cleanse the lepers, he can do these things. And he said He can dry up the cancer cells in your body, He can bring you wealth in your poverty, He can, and the whole issue is, when He says He can, that's true enough. But you know, what God can do isn't even part of my interest. I don't care what He can do. Anybody that confronts omnipotence with any kind of hesitation is just dumb. God, obviously, being omnipotent, can do, but that doesn't give anybody any real comfort. The comfort comes when He says He will do. So, can do doesn't help. Will do does. And the leper in Mark 1 said that. You can cleanse me if you're willing. And his problem wasn't with the can do, it was with the will do. And that's the same thing with the preaching of the particulars, because the preacher went from the can to the will. He said, because He can drive the cancer cells in your body, He will. Then you have to decide whether that's true. And that's the problem of faith. You have to be able to hear the particulars and decide whether the preacher just told you the truth or not. And then, having heard it and decided that it is true, you still have this hard difficulty within of saying, oh, okay, I'll yield to that. Or, oh, man, that's probably true, but I ain't going there. And that's the harder problem. But discerning is difficult enough. So those are the things that create that horsehair that holds that sword of accursedness constantly over the head of those who hear and respond in some way to the preaching. Preaching and receiving. The problem of determining the truthfulness of the particular declarations that are being made is compromised by the presence of deceit. Deception is the big problem. It's the insertion of darkness into the light. It was the initial, "You will not die," of Genesis 3. Deceit. And because deceit has been around for 6,000 years, it's got so many variations and forms, that is a significant challenge to believe. Because you don't know if you're being deceived or not. And then, the ability to embrace what you do decide is true is challenged by or compromised by the presence of fear. I mean, there's a reason we don't yield automatically to the things that we hear that we say, "Well, yeah, that's what the Bible says, but I'm not going there." Why not? Boils down more times than not to fear. I don't want to deal with what that would bring about in my life. I'm afraid. I'm not going to go there. And those two things combined, the deceit and the fear, is what that's what creates the horsehair. That very tenuous thing that keeps you in fear of this double curse in verses 8 and 9. Now, the consistent biblical teaching then is what we believe matters. But there is another consistent biblical teaching. That's kind of like saying the general tenor of Scripture. I warned you about that a couple of weeks ago. But the consistent biblical teaching in regard to grace and faith is that if there is any such thing as salvation, if that's anywhere close to a reality, then grace says that it has to be God who brings the light of discernment and the courage to embrace it. That's the grace issue of salvation, where God has to cut through the deceit and show the truth is true. Somehow he's got to bring light into this darkness in such a way that the hearer of the preaching can say, "Yeah, that's true. I can see that as clear as day." And then he's also got to overrule that natural fear that is almost invariably the reaction to truth in the human heart. He's got to give courage where there's fear, so that the person says, "I can see that's clear as light as day. I can see that if I buy into that, then these possibilities will develop, and I'm scared of having to face that." And somehow God comes along and says, "Well, give me your fears and embrace it anyway." And you do, if you believe. Because that's the way he works. That's the concept of grace and faith in a general biblical sense. So that's the first thing that I think we need to understand when we address the question in verse 10 of what is Paul really trying to do in verse 10 that will enable the Galatians to be recipients of the grace and the peace that comes from believing. So that brings us to his words. What does he really mean in the phrase, "For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God?" And the key thing there is the word pytho. I'm not aware of any place I know in the King James translation, the word's never translated out of the 50-some-odd times that it's used. I don't see where I wrote that down, but it's 55 times that it's used. It's never translated, "Am I seeking the favor of?" So why did the New American Standard translators decide to go there? And that's the issue. The King James, though it doesn't make a lot of sense to us, perhaps, with the question, "Am I persuading man or God here?" That has its problems, too. But they were trying to be consistent with the way they understood the word all the time, because about 20-some-odd times out of the 55, it's translated "persuade." And then a bunch more times it's translated "convince" or "trust," And I think 6 out of the 55 has what Strong calls miscellaneous translations, which means they, you know, persuade or convince or whatever, it didn't work for them. But it does raise the question, why would Paul use the word pytho in respect to men or God? And to answer that, we have to figure out what that word means. So what does pytho mean? Well, generally, what we're looking at are two questions and a statement in verse 10 that pytho introduces in the first question. Am I doing this to men or to God? This, whatever pytho means. Am I doing this to men or to God? Because when the Galatians answer that, they'll have part of the solution to Paul's statement of his motivation in verse 10. They'll have a clearer understanding of what he's trying to do. Because he's asking them, what am I trying to do? And is it in regard to men or to God? So, the first thing that we really have to do is deal with this word pytho and see how we should consider it. Since it's used 55 times in the New Testament, we really do have plenty of texts and contexts to give us some input on meaning. So we look that word up in those contexts and we discover that basically the word pytho is used consistently to address a three-part process with an emphasis perhaps on one of those parts. The three-part process is this. When the word pytho is used, the issue is always the speaker attempting to get the hearer to agree with what he's saying. That's always there. That's why they translate it half the times at least, persuade. Pytho means, I'm trying to get you to buy into what I'm saying here. That's the fundamental idea. That's the first part of the process, and that's the way the word is used half of the times. Then, in conjunction with this, attempting to get you to believe me, to buy into what I'm saying, to accept it as true, there is a whole bunch of texts where the word is used as a description of what happened when you heard this. In other words, the word is used, I am persuaded, or I am convinced, or I trust in. But the issue is, the first part of the process had been done, and now I'm reacting to it, and that's the word pytho is used for the reaction too. It's kind of like the way words shift. I think you've probably all heard me say this in some time past, but the word eucharisteo means generally to give thanks. I give thanks. The word eucharisteo was coined to mean I have been well graced. And then it got to be used as the response to the grace that had been given. So I was thankful. So the word started this way and then it kind of shifted in terms of the way people used it. They used it for the reaction rather than the initiation. Well, in the same way, pytho in the Bible has times when it means I'm trying to persuade you. But other times it means it worked. I'm persuaded. And then a few times it's used and is translated obey, which means that it's the third step in the process. You hear something that's an argument for your confidence. You are persuaded by that argument and you are convinced. And as a result of your being convinced, now your behavior is being affected by it. And you're actually operating in harmony with the thing that was declared to be true. Because you were convinced that it was true. And now you're acting. So the word pytho has these three parts. Where the information's being proclaimed is true. The second part is the hearer is saying, I accept that as true. I'm embracing it, I'm yielding to it as truth. And then the third part is, and from that yielding, these behaviors spring. They come out of it. You heard it, you believed it, and now you're acting in accordance with what you've accepted as truth. And that's the concept of pytho as you use it, as you look at it in the New Testament. And you have to be careful about it, because we have groups in the Christian tradition that tell you that the Bible emphasizes that you must obey the gospel. And they say by that that you have to be baptized, and you have to do this, and you have to do that, and if you don't, you'll perish, and if you do these, but then you behave badly later, you'll lose what you got, and on and on and on. Well, that obey, a lot of times in the scriptures, is the word pytho, and it means that you are responding because you've been convinced in a behavior form. So obeying the gospel is probably a bad translation. It means you have been convinced that it's true. So it's the middle of the process rather than the end. But the translators don't recognize that. They put the end in there where it ought to be in the middle. That ought to be the convincing thing. So that's what's going on. The question is, okay, what's going on here? Is Paul seeking to persuade somebody? Or has somebody been convinced? Or is he summoning them to some kind of activity that will be in harmony with something that they've been convinced? And he's asking this in relation to men or God. Well, he's not trying to get God to obey anything. So that doesn't really fit the question. Am I seeking to get God to obey something, or am I seeking to get men to obey something? That doesn't really fit. So the question is, am I seeking to be convincing to men or to God? That fits the issue of pytho, but it raises the question of, I can see where he would say, am I trying to convince men, because you can do that. But how could he use that term in relation to God? Am I seeking to convince God? And the question there is, how much of this Jewish deal is in his thinking? Because I believe that holy harshness, this pronunciation of a double curse on somebody, I believe that holy harshness is a fundamental part of legalism. And I believe that legalists often think that by being wholly harsh, they can persuade God that they're qualified for his favor. Because that's what legalists do. They try to convince God that they have done a sufficient amount to be accepted to him, or by him, be acceptable to him. Whether you can do that or not is a whole different question, but I think they try. In fact, Jesus condemned the lawyers for putting burdens on men that were so heavy that they couldn't bear them, but then they wouldn't turn around and lift a finger to help them. Well, what is the motivation for that kind of holy harshness, except their attempt to impress God with how committed they are to him so that he'll accept them? If you approach God on the basis of, here, let me show you how dedicated I am to you, you're going to come away with an empty hand. Because he doesn't see that kind of loyalty on our part. We see it in our blindness, perhaps, about us. But the truth is, the longer anybody really walks in the light, the less qualified they feel to have any kind of acceptance before God on the basis of anything they've done. Even the Apostle Paul, who is probably the pristine example of what everybody ought to be like, except for Jesus. As he lived his life and ministered and wrote the words of the New Testament, he moved in his thinking. He started out as the least of the apostles in this early letter. Well, that's pretty humble. But just a little bit later on, he said that he was less than the least of all saints, and that's even more humble. And then just before he died, he wrote to Timothy and said that he was the chief of sinners. And that's about as humble as you get. So I see Paul moving in his own Christian development. I mean, he said to the Philippians, I haven't arrived, but he was in the process. So if he's in the process, you're going to see some indications of that. And I think we see that in that progression. And what that means is, the closer you get to the light, the more you see the reality of your own uncleanness, and the more you see it, the less qualified you feel. So I really think that feeling really unqualified is an indication of some level of maturity. And feeling really qualified is a real strong indication of gross immaturity. It's a blindness. So I think that when he asked the question, am I seeking to convince men or God, I think there was a way in which you could understand somebody using a very harsh declaration like, let him be accursed. If you don't hear what I said, let me say it again. Let him be accursed. Now, am I trying to convince men or God here? That's what he's asking. And what kind of answer can we give? Well, I don't think that Paul was still operating on his former Jewish mentality, and I don't think he was asking the Galatians to believe that he was. When he said, am I seeking to convince men or God? I think the answer has to be he was seeking to convince the Galatians. That's what he wrote it for. So when he says this as an anticipation of their being offended by what he says in verses 6 to 9, his first thing is, well, what do you think I'm trying to do here? Do you think I'm trying to be wholly harsh so that I'm trying to persuade God of some kind of superiority on my part over you because you guys are departing from him who called you and let everybody be accursed who doesn't agree with me and all? Do you think I'm trying to convince God of that? Or do you think I'm trying to convince you of something? So I believe that the answer to the first question is, men, I'm seeking to convince men. But then he followed it with another question. Or am I striving to please men? And this is really where it gets into the issue, because if Paul is really trying to convince men, if that's really what he's doing, if the answer to the first question is men, I'm trying to convince men, okay, then what's going to keep them from being convinced? They're going to have to say either, well, what he said in verses 69 is true, or it's a lie. We're going to be convinced by them, or we're going to reject them, one or the other. Well, what did he say? Two things that were very difficult for them to swallow. Number one, you guys are moving away from the God who called you. And it just shocks me. They're going to be offended by that if, in fact, it's true. And then secondly, they're going to be offended by this very narrow harshness of anybody that doesn't agree with me is dead wrong, and they're going to go to hell for it. He's attempting to persuade them that that's true, but that raises the real issue, and that's in the second question, his real motivation. Who am I seeking to please here? You or God? Now, obviously, if the answer to that is you, I'm seeking to please you here. He obviously never read How to Gain Friends and Influence People, or Win Friends and Influence People. That's not how you do it. If you want to please me, you don't insult them, and you don't call down the fire of eternal Gehenna on their head. That's not how it works. So what he's really doing in the second question is raising the issue that we said have said in our studies up to this point, and that is the most fundamental reason for not trusting what somebody says is that you don't believe they're trustworthy. And that means that you think they're falsely motivated. And the issue of being falsely motivated is the issue of who are you trying to please here? Because Jesus said it this way. If you're trying to seek the favor of men, if you want to be big in their eyes, you cannot be trusted. But if you're willing to seek the glory that God gives, if you're willing to seek glory for God in the issues, then you will only do righteousness, and that makes you trustworthy. And he even said that in John's gospel, when they accused him of misrepresenting the truth and deceiving the people, he said, I don't seek my own glory. Which was a statement about I'm trustworthy. So what Paul is asking them here is, am I trying to convince you or God? And the answer should be, well, you're trying to convince us, but we don't like what we're hearing here. Well, the question then is, all right, how do you see what I'm trying to accomplish here in terms of pleasing people? Or who am I trying to please? You? Well, obviously I failed to do that. I've just insulted you and offended you big time. The question is, am I seeking to please God? Because at the end of the verse he says, if I was still trying to please men, I wouldn't be a bondservant of Christ. Well, what does that mean? Well, the word Christ is the term that has to do with the ruler of the kingdom. And being a servant of the Christ means that the Christ is a servant and you're a servant of him. Because the servant king is what the Christ is, and to be a servant of his means that you've fallen into line with his character and approach to things. And he's saying there's only one thing that'll keep that from happening, and that is if you'd rather please somebody else. So they might say, well, I think you're a man pleaser. But if they do, they'll do it in the face of verses 6 through 9. It doesn't sound like man pleasing to anybody. But if, on the other hand, they say, well, I guess that means you're a God pleaser, then they've got to deal with his accusations. And they have to say, well, if you're a God pleaser, you must be telling us the truth. And if you're telling us the truth, then not only are we departing from God, but those that are pushing us away from him are going to perish if they preach a false gospel. Those are the only options they got. But he did that on purpose because verse 10, I think, is Paul's second or maybe third statement in this book so far about the motivation of the preacher. In verse 1, he identified himself as Paul instead of Saul. And we, in our study of that, we said the reason was that he was done with trying to be the big shot in the eyes of men. That was his first opening statement about his motivation. And then at the end of verse 5, or at the end of the introduction in verse 5, he ascribes the glory to the Father, and that means he's not seeking it for himself. So at the beginning of the introduction, at the end, he still has this issue of, are you going to be able to and willing to accept what I'm writing to you in this letter? And in the introduction, he lays the foundation for their acceptance by telling them, I'm doing this to please God. And in that, you can trust me. I'm his apostle. I'm not trying to pull the wool over your eyes. I'm trying to represent him as he is. Then, in verses 6 through 9, he unloads on them. But then in verse 10, he comes right back and says, now remember what my motivation is here. I am trying to persuade you, trying to convince you. But I know that the convincing is only going to come if you really buy into the fact that I'm representing the servant king as one of his servants. If you buy that, then the rest of what I have to say to you, Paul says, you can accept as truth. But if you don't, then you might as well quit reading right here. In a very real sense, verse 10 is a sharp presentation of the real issues of their faith. They're going to either accuse him of false motives so that they can justify themselves and go on about their rat killing in the way that he's accused them of doing, or they're going to be caught flat-footed with the realization that he really is representing the servant king and what he's saying about us really is true. So I think that's what's going on here. Now, it is problematical because of the way the grammar runs together, but I really think that's what's happening. So, are there any comments or questions that brings to mind in verse 10? Because if not, we're going to start verse 11 next time. Verse 10 is a standalone summons to, well, what do you think about what I'm saying to you, Paul says. What do you think I'm trying to do here? Because it's going to govern it. If you don't think I'm trying to please God in this, which boils down to trying to help you. If you don't think that, you might as well just quit reading. The very next thing he says, verse 11, is, I want you to know that the gospel that I preach is not from men. He's going to make a pretty strong argument in the next chapter and a half, or this, the rest of this chapter and all of chapter 2, that he is an authoritative apostle representing the truth absolutely accurately. But to believe that, you got to believe he's representing God and trying to please him, not men. Well, then I'll just turn.